Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Greg Hutchins.
Hey, Greg. Hey, one of the comments we were chatting just briefly before we hit record here, and I've learned the hard way, is to not talk an idea or a topic all the way through before we hit record, because trying to re-record it after we've already talked about it. But you mentioned something that you saw a statistic or a change that occurred in a professional organization that was pretty dramatic. And I don't think it's unique just to the ASQ organization. I think other organizations, and we've talked about this on and off over the years, but what was some of the details around that? What was that number, and why would it?
Boy, ASQ is the American Society for Quality. It's probably the voice for the quality profession worldwide. Yeah, great organization, great people, great commitment, great public cause.
Lots of volunteers.
Lots of volunteers. And here's the number I saw. I saw it on LinkedIn, Restore ASQ, yesterday. And the number was, in 1998, ASQ had 140,000 members. Now, 2022, yeah, it's got 40,000. Yeah. How can an organization go from 140 to 40,000? That's almost a attrition rate of, 75%? And that sort of brought up the fact that another statistic, the number of Fortune 500 companies that were on the NASDAQ New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, say 20 years ago, only maybe 20% are left.
Yep.
Which basically means that the life expectancy of an organization like ASQ or even a publicly held company is very short these days. And that really brought up the idea of, why is this happening and what can be done about it?
Well, I mean, there's famous stories too of was it Xerox, I think, or Kodak. I think it was Kodak. Their story of they basically invented or had access to early digital cameras, and they basically said, "Well, that's not our business. We make film." Right, and there's business books written about this, how organizations, you know, stay to their core and then disruption occurs and their market just disappears because they're making buggy whips and Henry Ford's cranking out Model T's. So professional societies run into this, magazines, newspapers, even people run into this. This is what we do, and this is the way we always do it. And I get it with people. You get in a habit, you get the routine. This has worked for me. I got personal success with it. But all of a sudden, nobody wants your buggy whips anymore, kind of thing. And you know, why do organizations, they're filled with smart people dedicated to making things happen, but why do they put blinders on?
You know, what stuns me is this really happens to, and you're right, Fred, it happens to companies, nonprofits, it happens to everybody. There seems to be almost, we came up with a new URL called disruptionrules.com. And what we're thinking is really talking about that. Disruption is everywhere. And we as a society, whether it's a government or politics or public policy, we're simply not prepared for it. And we're not trained for it in school.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's a whole other subject in itself, is we're way too close to the factory model of education. And, you know, sit in the straight line. Well, I heard just yesterday that the SAT, the exam process is getting rid of number two pencils and filling in bubbles. They're actually going to use tablets now. and they're going to make it only 2 hours long instead of 3 hours or 3.5 hours or something like that. And one of the citations was the new generation doesn't know how to use a pencil. It was kind of I'm paraphrasing slightly.
Well, you know, that that points us to the fact that you and I, Fred, are sort of Gutenbergs.
Yeah, when it comes to that, yeah.
Digital fluent or digital native.
You know, but you and I both, though, we've talked about, you know, being earlier adopters for all kinds of stuff. Different technologies, right. Different methodologies, different. We'd pick up a book and get a zillion ideas and go explore half of them. I don't know how many gadgets I've got that I, you know, played with and go, well, you know, this isn't really there yet. And I mean, I had Palm Pilots from their first edition. And it was not much better than a Rolodex, all intent and purposes, but it you know, I was exploring it. I to me, part of this of why if an organization can change is that they have to be willing to recognize potential. What's the upside risk for these other areas? But also it's the being willing to fail. Yeah, we're going to put $100 million in this and it may not work, but we'll learn something. It's okay. Was it Microsoft recently said they're going to go buy Activision? Is that the name of the game company that they write video games?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and investors or the business news I'm hearing is this is a big gamble for them, you know, but they're willing to take it and they're looking at way ahead. And Microsoft's still around and they're still. And they've cranked out hundreds of products that are just failures. They keep going, though. I don't know anybody that still has a Microsoft-based phone.
Well, it's interesting. Taking risks and smart risks. In a previous podcast, I used the term that I learned called one trial learner.
Yeah.
Which means that you do something once, and then you learn from it, and then try something else. Unfortunately, a lot of organizations, probably a lot of people like me, are in trial learners. We do the same thing over and over again, expecting different outcomes, which I think somebody defined as idiocy.
Yeah. I've heard that attributed to Einstein a couple of times.
Is it okay?
Yeah. But the idea is that, I mean, sometimes organizations do learn and they persevere and they come out with 3M. It's hard to define what they really do. They're in medical systems, they're in polymers and adhesives, they're into, you know, just about everything you can think of. But they continuously crank out new products into new markets. Apple has been doing that, not as much recently, but there's rumors that they're moving into other areas already. Microsoft certainly keeps moving into stuff. Google. Oh man, I don't know how many, you know, different places they're into. But the irony is those are the exceptions. Whether an individual that just loves the early adopter, you know, syndrome and well, yeah, let's try it, you know. Hey, it's time to jump off this bridge. You know, want to see if this rubber band will hold me?
You know? You know, you bring up a good point. It's interesting. We can identify the companies that normally don't do it well, meaning innovate, mm-hmm. change, adapt. I mean, I go back to the old days of GE. GE 10, 15 years ago was the most valuable company in the world. You know, right. We call it market capitalization. They brought in some CEOs. They didn't adapt. And all of a sudden, they lost, I think, about 90% of their value. And, you know, it's, again, great people, great techniques. You know, they were some of the best users of quality methods in the world, Six Sigma. Mm-hmm. You don't remember who was the CEO that time who really popularized
it? Jack Welch, is that right?
Jack
Welch,
exactly.
I always confuse him with a linebacker.
it was Welch, exactly. Great technique, pushed it, you know, pushed quality and pushed Six Sigma. Over the top, everybody was doing 100% trading on it.
No, I'm just thinking, you know, part of that, though, I mean, there was a top-down expectation you're going to do it, but there was also, he was willing to let people and parts of his organization learn. Let's try it, you know? you do an examination and study, and the data says go this way, but sometimes that doesn't give you the right answer. And he says, well, you're following the process, try again. I think he only took that on so long before he says, well, we need a new leadership here. But
you're right.
But there was a space to try it, to make it happen and learn along the way, knowing that it's not overnight that you become a master black belt. You got to learn as you go, and that's okay. And that's what I experienced when I was at HP, was that, yeah, there's all kinds of cool techniques and processes and everything else, and tech and, you know, ways to do stuff. And I really got into reliability engineering because somebody said, oh yeah, there might be a role there for us in the organization if we do that. And so I got 1/4 of a full-time equivalent time. So I got less than 1 day a week to go explore this idea of talking about reliability. And it became very, very successful.
And people saw that. You're basically an evangelist. People saw the value, understood the personal value, like what's in it for me, and basically ran with it.
Yeah. And yet my predecessor, the CEO in the early 80s said, hey, our warranty costs are getting too high, and we're moving into more consumer market, and we need to change something. And so he initiated a 10X program. So we're going to reduce warranty costs by an order of magnitude. And over the decade, and it happened to be 1983 when he came out with that. So they were down 3 years already. And so they did surveys, learned a lot, they shared best practices, they did a lot of training. And the CEO went to every division regularly and said, how are you making improvement? What are you fixing? What are you updating? It was just beating the drum continuously for 7 years. At the end of the decade, they claimed victory. I think they were at 9.6 or something like, instead of 10, they reduced it, ended up saving over that decade over $1 billion. And in the times, that was a lot of money.
It still is now.
Yeah. And they called it success. And they dismantled all of the reporting structures, and they dismantled all of the reinforcement from the senior managers. And they went on to profitability, or they're on to innovation, or whatever the next focus was. And within 3 years, they were back right on the trajectory that the original reason they focused on it, they'd lost all that head ground. And we're back on that original projected slope and losing $1 billion a year, basically. And so the change takes a lot of energy to make it systemic within an organization. That's my point. And I think some of the headwinds for organizations is that there's not a champion that's willing to stick it out for the 15 years it's going to take to make it work. Whereas Jack Welch did. He was there a long time and beat that drum continuously, right? But then when he left, it got dismantled pretty quickly.
Yes, and I can share with you a story. Yeah, so when I was setting up a quality program many, many years ago, I went from, an engineer level, essentially, to a director level, a program director level.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I always lose good engineers that way.
And that's the point. I went from a techie person solving problems to basically managing projects, people. And people management, by their nature, is...
It's not engineering.
It's not engineering. And I was spending 70 to 80% of my time coaxing, training, mentoring other people in this program, as opposed to solving problems, And by the way, I wasn't making decisions anymore. I was facilitating others making decisions and becoming winners during that process, right? Because I never took ownership. I was more of a facilitator rather than a manager or a leader, more than anything.
Right.
That was a big transition. And working with people at that level, 12 hours a day, 5-6 days a week, which means it's a 60-70 hour week.
Yeah.
Is very emotionally time consuming. And at a certain point, I think people just simply say, I want something simpler and easier.
and oftentimes that's, let's do it. Worked last year. Let's do what we know, you know. And there is a business, I think there was even a book, is do what's in your core, outsource everything else, right?
Yep.
I ran into one division that they took that to heart, and they outsourced even the design of their product. So the design, the manufacturing, the distribution, the customer service, all of it was outsourced. There was only three people in the division. And all they did was write contracts to everybody else to do that, create these products.
That's another podcast of the make or buy decision and the wisdom now of reshoring and insourcing.
Yeah, so that's true. Yeah. I think we're going to have some new books coming out pretty quick on supply chain stuff. And there's no doubt about it. But the organization, I mean, one way to make an organization change is, you know, shut down Long Beach and LA docks so that you can't get any parts. Now what are you going to do? That creates a change.
Well,
I was going to say is I just saw yesterday, and this is, you know, probably old news now when the podcast comes out, but Intel decided they're going to put $20 billion into a wafer fab systems in, I think, Ohio someplace. Like, that's onshoring big time.
Yes, and a lot of strategic reasons for that. So Samsung is basically building $17 billion worth of plants in Texas. Intel, $20 billion, which could be a $100 billion investment in Ohio.
Yep.
Again, it comes down to bringing that, you know, that core capacity, that core capability of design and manufacturing in-house again. So we're on to something there, but that's another podcast probably.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, we'll make a note. We'll come back to that one. But I mean, the organizations have been outsourcing, I mean, and even getting into the political liaisons with other countries to open up trade and do all this stuff so that we can offshore more often. And now it's over the last couple of years, people are going, maybe that's not the right idea. Maybe we need to bring that back. So there's seismic changes is kind of the way I would phrase those things. Let's circle back to ASQ because, right. You know, and I was familiar with them, but I wasn't willing to volunteer my heart and soul to drive a change through this organization that just really didn't want to change. And some of it was, is that, you know, they were facing funding problems. Once they start losing membership and they're not growing anymore, then the investments and the building and the infrastructure that they have to support becomes a burdensome. And so the focus is on making the next quarter's numbers so they can pay their bills. Now, I don't know all the ins and outs and all the details of it, but the folks I talked to on and off over the years seemed to me have really had lost what was the purpose of the organization. And it wasn't to make money. It was to serve their members. And they get intertwined, and then the core mission got lost. And so I think the organization changed, not to their benefit. And what I don't get is that they're smart, talented people, yet there wasn't anybody that I could recognize that would stand up and be heard. There's a couple of folks you and I have talked about that have stood up and said, hey, this needs to change, and made a pretty compelling reasons for it, and was basically ostracized and say, no, it's too radical. We can't deal with that. You know, it's like, what I don't get is so many organizations do that. And some of it is because the ground is shifting. I mean, we have podcasts. And I remember when I was the reliability division chair, I said, hey, we should let our members know about what's all the calendar events, where are all the conferences, where are all the other stuff. And I got slapped on the wrist saying, no, you can't advertise anything that we don't make money from. All right, fine. I'll create my own website. Do it off as a side hustle. And it's still running. And it gets thousands of entries a year of activities and events. And certainly I'm not involved with hardly any of them, or to a large degree, none of them. And there's no fee to sign up for it and everything else. But I've run into organization after organization, professional societies in particular. They don't want to talk about or acknowledge that AMA exists, or the stats, ASA, American Statistical Association, is a massive organization, or mechanical engineers, ASME, or IEEE, or any of the other ones exist or want to work with them. They're the evil competitors. And I'm like, I think you're missing the point here, guys.
Boy, we bring up, not we, I, you bring up a lot of core issues. And I've tried to change these organizations or even have them adapt. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very tough. And I think you nailed it with that story with the camera company. They basically wanted to make cameras, or they wanted to make film. They didn't want to move to the digital realm. Yeah. Once something works and we feel comfortable with it, we'll fall back always on it. That's the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Change, variety, and certainty is difficult. And it's not the easy path, right, that a lot of organizations want to take. Because they want certainty. They want, you know, they want a compelling reason. Why should we move when what we're doing is successful?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's exactly true. What was the, it's not Deming's quote. It was, he's a business guru guy. Change is not required, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's rest in peace these days. That's a sort of prescription for.
Definitely. Now, so I'm thinking, you know, this. I don't think we have any solutions there at all. I think it's recognizing that, yeah, organizations can change, and there's probably multiple ways that can occur. Sometimes it's outside forces. Sometimes it's really core group of people that can implement the change, even from within the organization, from whatever position. There's all kinds of ways it can be done. Yet I think the consistent piece of what we talked about, Greg, is that it's not easy. And it's often not even recognized that change needs to be done. And that's a hard part, in my mind anyway. But if you're, you know, you're listening to this and you're facing change, and Greg, you've used the phrase VUCA.
Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity.
Right. Which, you know, you said we're in a VUCA time, right? It's, yeah, there's no doubt about that. And it's, whether it's accelerated or not, it's probably a subject for another conversation. But the idea is that, yeah, stuff happens. And sometimes a good disaster is an opportunity to make some changes, but you don't always have to wait for it. So if you're facing one or more of these kinds of challenges and have some success stories or have some questions or ideas or what would like us to chat about it here on the show, please do join the conversation. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there you can find a widget to leave us a voice message. I think it's up to 90 seconds. Or you can write us a comment or a question or an idea. You can also find Greg and I on LinkedIn, as well as the other hosts of the show, or on the About pages on Ascendo. So there's plenty of ways for you to join the conversation. So I think that'll wrap us up for today, Greg. Any? We'll have to come back. I think we, what, mentioned four different topics to come back to?
I know, Fred. I totally agree with you. Please chime in with your thoughts and ideas. I need to hear them. I also need to get a lot smarter, and you're the way that make me smarter. So thank you very much.
All right. Well said, Greg. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.